morning. Good morning. We're going to get started with this special meeting of the Safety and Operations Committee to hear a report on the incident in the tunnels overnight between Sunday and Monday. So in terms of the agenda, if there's no objection, can we consider the agenda approved as presented? Are there any objections? Thank you. Seeing none, the agenda is approved. It's a special meeting. We don't have minutes to approve today for a prior meeting. We call today's meeting to have a public presentation and discussion regarding the collision that occurred between two out-of-service trains early Monday morning. While the investigation is still ongoing, staff will be able to give us an overview of what is known at this point and the next steps in the investigation and the follow-up actions to be taken. I'll turn the floor over to the general manager, the COO, Mr. Lever, and the Chief Safety Officer, Teresa Imposato.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also is Lisa Woodruff, who runs our rail service division. Before I turn it over to Teresa and to Joe, just to make a few comments. First, I wanted to thank Teresa and particularly Ms. Woodruff. I mean, these people were working, you know, the last 36 hours straight or whatever it was to get on this and their team, so thank you for that. Also wanted to thank all of our partners, whether it's the Safety Commission, the NTSB, and actually the FTA as well for their involvement in this. And most importantly, obviously, I want to thank the customers for some of their patience on Monday morning and Monday evening. But also, we just want to draw your attention, a little bit of the change of culture here. As you know, we focus on safety versus service. And, you know, the reality is with those trains in the tunnel there, we had the opportunity physically to move those trains out of there and probably meet the PM peak. And the pushback that we internally had came from operations and from air safety people saying, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to find out what exactly we want to make sure we do the forensics correctly. There's information in there that if we move those trains, start running trains, we're going to lose. So we want to make sure we do that right. So it did impact our customers for the evening peak. Again, we apologize for that. But it's a reflection of the culture that when we see a problem, we're going to find out what the root cause is and move from there. So I wanted to thank, again, both Joe and Teresa and Lisa for sort of pushing that issue all the way through the organization. So with that, turn it over to Teresa to start.
Good morning, members. In light of the events which occurred in the early morning hours on Monday, October 7th, I'd like to provide a preliminary briefing to the board on the progress of the investigation to date. Respectfully, I ask that you hold your questions until the presentation has been completed. It's likely that they'll be answered in subsequent data review. This briefing will include an executive summary, a review of the incident response and recovery chronologies, a review of the investigation process, as well as a review of the preliminary findings, a general overview of the automatic train control system, and finally, a review of the remaining areas of inquiry in the investigation and the anticipated timeline for reporting. Two trains were involved in the collision. Both were out of service with no passengers on board at the time of the incident. The operators of both trains reported non-life-threatening injuries. They were treated and released. Metro is currently conducting a detailed assessment of the damages to the equipment. While the investigation is ongoing, preliminary findings do not establish evidence of systemic causal factors. Human factors remain under review as part of the ongoing investigation. The graphic on the screens above and behind me depict the area of the track in which the incident occurred. At approximately 12:48 a.m. on Monday, October the 2nd, an inbound six-car non-revenue train ID 700, collided with a stationary six-car train ID 755, on track 1, approximately 600 feet outside of the Farragut West station limits. The estimated speed at the time of impact was approximately 11 miles per hour. At the time of the incident, train 755 was stationary and awaiting an automatic train protection speed command due to a train within the limits of the Farragut West station. At 12:51, train operator of 755 reported to the Rail Operations Control Center that it felt as if something struck the rear of his train. The Rail Operations Control Center communicated with the train 700 operator at that time, who confirmed that his train had made contact with train 755. Both trains were 3,000 series trains. The above depicts an approximate chronology of the incident response and the subsequent efforts for the restoration of service. Times are approximate and subject to change as the investigation proceeds. DC Fire, Emergency Medical Services, and Metro Management responded to the scene and established incident command. Both operators requested medical attention and were transported from the scene for evaluation and treatment. Upon notification from the Rail Operations Control Center, Metro officials responded to the incident and began a preliminary assessment of the scene. Metro Transit Police Department secured the scene as the conditions were documented. As Mr. Wiedefeld stated, both trains remained at the incident location to support the investigation and to minimize subsequent impacts to service. The trains were removed Tuesday morning after it was safe to do so and confirming that the on-scene data collection had been completed. The investigation is ongoing, with Metro leading the coordination and exchange of information with the WMSC and the NTSB. Notifications were made to the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission and the National Transportation Safety Board in accordance with regulatory requirements. Metro has kept NTSB apprised of the progress of the investigation, and the WMSC has participated in the interview process and assisted in the on-scene data collection efforts throughout the process. The on-scene collection of data included in-situ photographic documentation, dimensional documentation of the equipment positions at their place of rest, infrastructure inspections, and securement of data recorders from both the signaling system and the train set. Additional data collection included securement of available CCTV footage, control center system playback recordings, and recordings of radio transmissions. Metro has also commenced assembly of historical data and has conducted a series of interviews with involved and affected individuals. With regard to the findings of the on-scene investigation, examinations of the train sets and the positions at which they came to rest indicated the wheels of both trains were resting on the running rails and the train sets were in their full and upright position. The second car of train 755 had separated from the third car of the consist. There was visual damage to both train consists involved, with the lead car of the 700 train sustaining the most damage. The extent of the damages to the train sets are currently being assessed by Metro and WMSC staff.
With just explain what the three photos are showing?
Those three photos are depicting exterior damage that was observed on the scene of the involved train sets. One shows some exterior car body damage, as well as some damage at the ends of trains and in the threshold areas. Respectfully, the findings which I'm about to review are preliminary in nature, and they represent the best available information at this stage in the investigation. As the investigation is currently in the data collection and fact-finding phases, information is subject to change upon further review and analysis. With regard to each engineered system, I'd like to give you a quick briefing as to the preliminary findings. Inspections which were conducted on scene of the track and infrastructure did not identify anomalies or any conditions which were out of tolerance. Tunnel lighting was fully functional and illuminated. Visibility was clear. A review of the inspection history of the track and infrastructure is currently in progress. With regard to the power system, inspections conducted on scene did not identify any anomalies or conditions which were out of tolerance. Review of the inspection history of the power systems is in progress. With regard to communications, communication systems were operational and performing as designed per inspections and testing conducted on scene and a review of communications logs. reviews of the communication system's history are in progress. With regard to the signaling system, inspections and testing conducted on scene did not identify any anomalies, conditions which were out of tolerance, or system failures. The review of the data recorders does not indicate any system failures. A review of the system history, operations, and maintenance records are in progress. With regard to the train set, inspections conducted on scene did not identify anomalies or conditions which were out of tolerance with the train set. Reviews of data recorders did not indicate a failure of the onboard signaling display system. Testing of the train set is in progress, as well as detailed damage assessments and a review of the train set kinematics. With regard to the Rail Operations Control Center, system playback review does not identify anomalies or other irregular conditions. Reviews of radio communications do not indicate any issues with transmission or reception. Communications quality appears clear, and all emergency protocols appear to have been followed. With regard to operational and human factors, initial reviews indicate normal operating conditions at the time of the incident. The personnel records of both involved operators show that they were current with all required qualifications and training. Metro safety staff, as well as the WMSC, have conducted initial interviews with both train operators. Follow-up interviews are planned. Both operators submitted to the required toxicology testing, the results of which are pending. Additional interviews with the Rail Operations Control Center staff are planned. The investigation will include a comprehensive evaluation of human factors, which will require considerable effort to establish the factual record and conduct advanced analytics. As part of this effort, system data recorder logs were secured and reviewed for each system element in isolation. No anomalies or system failures were observed. As the investigation progresses, this data will be fused into an integrated review of the aforementioned systems, which will confirm the preliminary findings. In light of numerous inquiries, I'd like to include in this briefing a high-level overview of the automatic train control system, its components, and a review of the functionality and design of the Automatic Train Protection, or ATP, system. The Automatic Train Control System provides for safe and efficient movements of trains through a series of track circuits and integrated logic for routing controls and speed controls. Major features of the ATC system include Automatic Train Protection, or ATP, Automatic Train Supervision, or ATS, and Automatic Train Operation, or ATO. Automatic Train Operation controls train speeds and braking automatically without requiring intervention from the operator. ATO can also be used to provide train berthing and door commands at stations. ATO is not in service at this time on the Metro system. Automatic Train Supervision systems provide dispatching functions. Automatic train supervision primarily provides dispatching, management of headways, routing of trains, and assistance in adhering to schedule. Finally, automatic train protection, or ATP, is the system that provides safe train separation. It should be noted that while a train is in manual mode or in automatic train operation mode, the ATP system is always active. The ATP system issues speed commands from wayside equipment to the train. Initial observations of data recorder logs indicate that both train 700 and train 755 received a zero speed command from the ATC system. Zero speed commands indicate that the track ahead is occupied or otherwise obstructed and require the train set to come to a stop. In the event the train does not come to a stop, the system is designed to engage the train set braking system to arrest the movement of the train. After the train set comes to a stop, the train can be moved at a reduced speed of up to a maximum of 15 miles per hour. Any such movement requires authorization from the Rail Operations Control Center. This is a standard system design in the transit industry in order to account for density and capacity in terminal and yard areas, as well as to permit flexibility for operational needs in the event of system interruptions, such as the recovery of a disabled train or an outage of the system. During the incident, all factual data that has been collected to date indicates that the ATP system functioned without failure nor anomaly. In 2016, Metro received a corrective action plan from the FTA, which required a review of options available for the implementation of a positive train stop function, which would reduce the likelihood of a red signal overrun. Metro has identified a solution and is working with vendors to implement the solution on the 6,000 and 7,000 series fleets. Positive train stop functionality has been included in future equipment specifications. Metro has been working with the WMSC to coordinate the implementation of the corrective action plan. Most recently in September, the WMSC issued approval of an implementation timeline for the system modifications. There is a subtle differentiation to be made between the positive stop corrective action plan and the circumstances of the incident which occurred. The circumstances of the incident which occurred did not occur with a violation of a red signal. The circumstances under which the incident occurred were a similar zero-speed command situation. Metro is performing an evaluation of the proposed system under which the cap will be addressed in concert with the investigation to identify any opportunities for enhancements or other modifications to the improvement. As the investigation continues, Metro will complete additional interviews with staff, will review the results of pending tests and data that have been collected. Metro will perform analytics of the data and interviews in order to identify the probable cause of the incident and contributing factors. After such time, Metro will be reviewing the current operational protocols and technology systems in order to identify potential modifications or improvements to processes and systems. Metro will participate in the WMSC Engineering Summit to review available technology options to enhance safety. Accordingly, corrective action plans to implement any identified modifications or improvements will be developed. Metro intends to submit the finalized report to the WMSC within an estimated time frame of 60 days. I thank you for your time and attention, and will answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Imposato. That was a very comprehensive report, and I appreciate it on behalf of the committee and on behalf of the board. I asked you to schedule this report today because I thought the board members, as well as the public at large, were entitled to a public presentation by WMATA on the accident at the earliest opportunity. And since we had a meeting scheduled for today of the board, I asked, and I appreciate your being able to put together the package for today. I'll start off with a couple questions, and then we'll move to other members of the committee and other board members at large who may have questions as well. This occurred with an out-of-service train. So my first question is, are the protocols for the running of a train and exceeding sort of speed when there is a red light on the block, are they different for the time period when revenue service is going on as opposed to the period after the system closes on weekdays at 11:30 or whenever it closed on that Sunday night because of the game? Are they different or are they the same throughout the day for operators as well as for the ROCC in directing the movement of trains?
The engineered systems rules, procedures, and administrative processes remain the same for non-revenue service trains as well as revenue service trains. The only differentiations there are how the trains would interact with the riding public and the associated procedures that would govern that.
Thank you. I wanted to clear that up. Second of all, and you alluded to this in your presentation, normally above ground when we drive cars, a red light means stop. I gather from your presentation that below ground, a red light doesn't necessarily mean stop. So even though the operator had a red line command and he did stop in the signal block as a result of that red signal, he was allowed to resume, either he was allowed under direction of the ROCC to resume forward progress under certain conditions. Could you explain, or Mr. Lutter explain, what those conditions are and why that is a standard practice in transit systems?
Okay, just to clarify, so there was not a red signal overrun in this case. The train lost speed command because the block, the signal block in front of them was occupied by another train. The reason why it's important to have to be able to pass when you lose speed command, to be able to have an operational procedure in place would be, for instance, if the train, the block ahead had a train that was disabled, and the way to get that train moved would be to couple another train to it, push it out of the way, or drag it out of the way, you would need some means to do that. So it is an industry standard to be able to, when you lose speed commands, or in the case of New York City Transit, where you have automatic signaling, you can key by your signals in order to approach or get trains as close as possible. But when we do that, there are procedures in place that must be followed. In this case, would be to call the Rail Control Center and receive permission to do so, and also there is a speed restriction when you do so.
So when the operator is in that block, even though the train can move forward under his command, he can't do so, or he should not be doing so, unless he has an authorization from the Rail Operation Control Center?
Correct.
Thank you. I have some other questions, but I'm sure other members of the committee do as well. Chair Smedberg?
Could we return to slide 12, please? Put that up. Especially in the, second to last bullet. So we were kind of discussing this, but there's the engineering rules, and then there's the policies and procedures. So when you get the zero speed command, who implements that? Is that automatically implemented by the machinery of the train, the circuitry of the train, or the operator?
It's implemented by the circuitry of the train in the event the operator fails to take action.
Okay. So the train itself, regardless of the operator, perceives that zero speed signal and acts on it if it doesn't perceive that the operator is acting on it.
That's correct.
Okay. And so once the train has come to a stop, does the train itself need any input other than the input by the operator to move up to 15 miles per hour? Or is that control, where such movement requires authorization from the ROC, is that a policy and procedure implemented by humans as opposed to by technology?
It is an administrative control.
Okay, so the train has no idea whether authorization has come or not from a circuitry standpoint. It has an input from the operator. It responds to the input from the operator. And then as long as that speed does not exceed 15 miles per hour, the automatic system would not intervene?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. So if, hypothetically, this train had accelerated up to or beyond 15 miles per hour, the automatic braking system would have kicked in?
That's correct.
If it had operated as designed. Okay, and there's no indication that it was not designed to kick in because the train did not exceed 11 miles per hour, as we understand it at this time.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Ms. Imposato, I'm curious, given the facts or some of the statements you've made here today, how does this play out in a timeline? What's the standard sort of process of an incident of this nature? How long should we expect the investigation to take? How long might it be before we have some sort of conclusions that we can, make appropriate steps if necessary?
There are a number of factors that affect the timeline for the investigation. As I stated earlier, this investigation will perform an in-depth human factors evaluation. Human factors evaluations are complicated by their very nature. They're not as discrete and simplistic as downloading an evaluation of systems. Human factors investigations at times require subject matter expert consultation as well as subjective judgments and require iterative processes to be executed. By virtue of the fact that the human factors investigation is in its very early, if not incipient, phases at this point, I think it is likely that it will probably be about 30 days or so until we have some additional factual findings on the human factors side. With regard to the engineered systems, within the coming weeks, we should have fused the data and should have confirmation of all of our preliminary findings within the engineering systems.
And usually the definitive statements or conclusions aren't made until an investigation is completed. Typically when you're investigating incidences of this nature or ones that might be more serious.
Yes, sir, that's correct. To make definitive statements at this point would be premature and would subsequently inject an element of bias into the human factors investigation aspects.
Thank you.
In an airline incident or accident, there's a cockpit voice recorder which would have a record of all communications and whatever else is said in the cockpit. Is there a similar data record here that establishes every communication back and forth, both from the ROCC and the operator of each of the trains during the period that's of concern here? Is it a total recording of all voice transmissions during this period? Do we have that?
Unlike the data recording systems in aviation, the data recording systems in the transit industry are largely individual streams of data. There are, in fact, data recorders that record the radio transmissions from the train sets to the Rail Operations Control Center. Unlike the 7000 series Consys, which represent more than half our fleet, this specific train set, the 3000 series, do not have inward-facing cameras, which would assist in the establishment of the factual record in this incident, which is also part of what is protracting the timeline around the human factors investigations. So there's no single source, but we can combine all of the individual sources in order to fuse the data and get a timeline of events.
So by fusing those sources, would you have a full record of all communications, say from 12:45, a few minutes before the incident, to 1:30 in the morning, that full 45-minute period?
The voice radio communications, yes, sir, absolutely.
Both ways?
Yes.
Thank you. Just one more question. And
yeah.
Because I'll just follow up on a point you made. On the 3,000 series cars, indicated that they don't have the inward-facing cameras. Is there anything else that we've included in more recent sets, the 7000 series trains, for example, that are not included in the 3000, which are some of the oldest trains in the current fleet, that are improvements in terms of either accident investigation or in preventing this kind of accident with the current fleet, the 7000 and a future fleet?
The 7000 series train set specification as well as future specifications take full advantage of the significant enhancements made to data collection as well as enhancements to train set crashworthiness. as well as enhancements to recording systems. There are additional safety systems on the 7000 series trains and additional safety systems that are specified for future procurements. I could provide a more detailed and thorough briefing at a future date for that.
I guess what I'm asking, is there anything, any system out there that would have prevented the incident? You know, by, you know, kind of think of a concept like, you know, if you get within 20 feet or 20 yards of the next train, it automatically forces a braking on the advancing train. Are there any systems like that that are in the market that are included in 7,000 or 8,000 specs?
I'm not aware of any such systems that are currently in use at transit properties across the nation. As we stated, this is standard system design in order to permit for recovery efforts as well as to account for scheduled disruptions.
So preventing an accident like this in the future is purely a human factors exercise or human factors responsibility?
Not entirely. I think it's premature at this point to ascribe causal factors solely to human factors. We do want to look into technology and look into technologies that are available to augment human performance and to enhance safety. So it is entirely possible that there are technology solutions that will improve our level of safety and subsequently reduce the risk of a repeat occurrence. But at this phase in the investigation, we can't conclusively state what those technologies may be and whether or not they're feasible.
Could this be something like a sticker shake or a blasting horn that goes off if you get to, you know, so much distance between an approaching train to warn the operator that he's in a dangerous zone there?
There are collision avoidance technologies that are out there. We have initiated an inquiry into the market to see what is commercially available and what's in use on other systems. So we are actively pursuing technology explorations.
Thank you.
You mentioned crashworthiness. Just briefly, to what extent is crashworthiness likely to be a focus of the investigation as opposed to prevention of understanding the cause of the incident and future incident, prevention of future incidents?
Focuses on crashworthiness are always focused on reducing severity of an incident. Our focus is primarily on reducing the likelihood of the incident. We want to study the behavior of the train sets in accordance with the investigation to determine whether or not there was any unexpected behavior. We don't believe crashworthiness to be a problem. We do believe that the 7000 series offers enhancements to crashworthiness, mm-hmm. which would reduce the severity of subsequent incidents. But we don't think at this point in the investigation that there was anything discovered that was problematic or atypical in the behavior of the train sets. We do need to continue conducting analytics to confirm that premise.
And just to make sure there's a good understanding of typical versus atypical, so unlike an automobile, there's no crumple zone on a transit rail car, correct? Nothing that 7,000 does? Okay.
7,000 does.
All right. So in this incident where an operator four cars ahead sustained non-life-threatening injuries with if this is too much speculation, don't answer, but with the enhancements of newer and better cars, would it reduce the likelihood of that operator or passenger four cars up from sustaining the types of injuries they would being in a 3000 series car?
It is speculative. The investigation doesn't have the details on the types of injuries, nor the specific transfers of energy throughout the train mm-hmm. set bodies.
Okay. I'm probably going too far down a speculative path here, so I'll leave it at that and follow up later if necessary. Thank you.
Part of the testing and the acceptance of the 7000 series, as well as what is in the 8000, is that the car builder demonstrates the crashworthiness. So they actually build a mock-up and have to crash it and show that the train operator's cab stays intact, that it can absorb the energy up to a certain amount, of, a certain speed, and that's in the contract specifications.
Mr. Woodard, those are NAFTA promulgated specs.
Yes.
They're not federally directed. I don't think
No, please.
I want to preface my question first by saying this is not only the safety committee but the operations committee. By saying that safety is sacrosanct, by saying congratulations on instituting or reinstating a culture that appropriately places safety first. My question is not informational or technical in nature, but really a suggestion and not a question. And I will lastly preface that question by saying that I have noticed when driving in a car signs on a road and not a transit facility that say in the event of crash that's minor, move to the side of the road, right? I want to ask my question from the standpoint of riders or commuters in particular who are affected by the delay. Is there reason to investigate formulating categories of incidents to distinguish those that do not require multiple hours of investigation that might impede the movement of users of the system from other categories of incidents that merit cessation of service for long periods of time? And do you see good reason to consider that? I think that you can place safety first and draw a distinction between safety as a priority, which you are successfully implementing, on the one hand, from investigation of incidents after the fact. Now, you may think that they are inextricably linked because there's lessons to be learned from investigations conducted in detail that will inform, you know, safety approaches or safety-driven considerations. But are there accidents that could be cleared to the side of the road for the sake of continued flow? That's a question I wouldn't expect you to answer now, but I'd recommend just considering it from the standpoint of riders who are, this is saying, get it out of the way. I got to get to work. But again, I'll conclude the question by congratulating you on reinstating a culture that appropriately places safety first and regards safety as sacrosanct. Thoughts? No, you don't have to answer. That's a point, not a question.
I definitely think that there's an optimization calculus that needs to take place in the face of any incident. With this one in specific, there was perishable evidence that needed to be preserved. So we made the difficult decision to impact our service in order to collect that evidence, which we believe will help point us towards the causal factors so we can avoid recurrence.
Okay. Good answer.
The other data point that went into the decision-making was the extent of the damage to the couplers and the fact that if you began to move a consist that may have a pull apart further down on the on one of the tracks, you would have now two incidents going on and really destroy service. So we wanted to make sure we understood exactly what damage the car sustained and how we were going to move them properly without incurring any further delays.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Curious, how are you coordinating your work, your investigation with the Safety Commission? Could you tell us a little bit about how that relationship works and how things are coordinated here? We've been seeing their name a lot in the press, so I just want to make sure we're in sync.
Metro notified the WMSC approximately 10 to 15 minutes after the incident had occurred. We've been in regular communication with Dr. Mayer and his staff with regard to collection of factual data. The WMSC has participated in our interviews. They have attended on-scene data collection activities, and we continue to regularly keep them apprised of any and all data points which we are collecting throughout the investigation. They have elected to oversee our investigation, and we are happily providing them any and all relevant information.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, just going forward, I think you indicated that you expected to complete the internal WMOD investigation and provide the MSC report within 30 days. Do you have an understanding of what their timeline is after that? Is their intention to put out a public report 30 days or 60 days after that, or what their procedures are? And second of all, you mentioned in the beginning that the NTSB was also involved. Could you just explain what your understanding is of their involvement would be in this investigation?
Certainly. Just to clarify for the record, the Metro timeline is 60 days for finalization of our report and transmission and submission to the WMSC. I cannot speak on behalf of the WMSC as to their intent with regard to whether or not they intend to publish an independent report. With regard to the NTSB, we have been in regular contact with the NTSB. We have been providing them updates on the status of our findings. We will share with them the results of our analysis. I also can't speculate as to the NTSB's intent with regard to releases of any of their reviews of our efforts.
Is management's intent to make your report to the MSC public at that point, or are you going to consider it a investigative report that is not public until released by the Metropolitan Safety Commission, Metro Rail Safety Commission?
It's our intent to comply with the program standard under which we're governed, the WMSC program standard, which requires submission of the reports for the WMSC's review and adoption prior to those reports being made public.
So we would be awaiting an actual action by the WMSC to make the report a public document.
That's correct, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions? Last round of questions? Thank you very much. Again, appreciate your being able to put together this package for today on such short notice. And hopefully we will go many days, many meetings until we have another report like this on short notice. Thank you again.
Thank you, sir.
That concludes this special meeting of the Safety Committee. I want to thank you. With no further business to come before the committee, we stand adjourned. I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Smedberg, who has a request to the board to meet in executive session.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. In accordance with the bylaws, I, Paul Smedberg, request that the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following matters pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, subsections A, litigation, investigations, and other legal matters requiring the provision of legal advice or consultation with counsel and staff members and personnel or labor issues, including discussions of labor contract and labor negotiations, consideration or interviews of candidates for employment, and the assignment, appointment, promotion, performance, demotion, or resignation of individuals. The board corporate secretary shall amend the topics as needed to reflect any additional matters discussed. Is there a second? Seconded by Mr. Bulger. All those in favor? All right. See you upstairs.